Alan Sachs is Dean and Professor of Law, Psychology, and Psychiatry and the Behavioral Sciences at USC's Gold School of Law. She studied at Vanderbilt, Oxford, Yale. She's written best-selling books, and she won a MacArthur Genius Grant. And she also has schizophrenia. If that comes as a shock to you, that those two attributes, scholar and schizophrenic, could be mutually compatible, then perhaps it's because of the stigma and misunderstanding that surrounds the illness. Ellen was fortunate enough to receive treatment and today has an impressive professional career, some of which has been inspired by her experiences. I was fortunate enough to be able to sit down and talk to Ellen on campus at USC. Here's our talk. I really enjoyed it.
I'm here with Ellen Sachs. Thank you so much for joining me.
Really great to be here, Duncan. Appreciate your asking.
So I wanted to talk to you because I got introduced to you and your work through your book, The Center Cannot Hold. Mm-hmm. You were at a point in your life where you're established, successful career. What made you decide to go public and produce a memoir?
I mean, that's a really good question. I thought about it for many years, and I was cautious and worried about doing it. But I don't know how I actually came to the decision, but one day I just thought, you know, telling this story could help people, and I would like that. And I actually have a colleague, an older woman who's a psychiatry professor at UCLA, and she said, Ellen, if you do it under a pseudonym. Do you basically want to become known as a schizophrenic with a job?
Right.
And I thought to myself, that's not how I want to be known, but doing it under a pseudonym just sends the wrong message, that this is just too awful, awful to say out loud.
Yeah.
So I did it under my own name, and my friend was totally wrong. I got a very positive and kind and supportive response for the most part.
What was the response among people?
You know, I got lots of emails and calls, and they're like kind of in different categories. So one group is, you know, thank you for giving us hope.
Yeah.
The second group is, how can I get my loved one to take medication? And sort of my husband says, if I knew the answers to that, I'd be the second schizophrenic with a Nobel. Yeah. John Nash. It's a hard question. Some people wanted to talk about alternative remedies that work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I kind of say is, you know, what I'm doing is working pretty well, and why change a winning course, but thanks.
Right.
And some people wrote to say they were praying for me, and I guess it can't hurt to be prayed for.
Yeah.
The funniest one came from a guy who said, Professor Sachs, you and the doctors are all wrong. You actually are a space alien, and the medicine's poison.
Okay.
So, got some like that as well.
So I was interested in kind of taking the course of the book, some of the earlier experiences you described. Where they're not full-blown psychotic episodes, but they're sort of warning signs.
Right.
And one of the earliest ones you mentioned was, I believe you asked your father to, like, go to the pool, or go into the pool.
Go to the beach, yeah.
Yeah, and he wasn't having it. And
right.
You sort of had this mental experience that you called disorganization,
yeah.
Which I think is a really good way of describing it. Can you sort of, what do you mean by disorganization?
The center isn't holding. So
right.
Basically it feels like your mind is dissolving and you can't sort of take things in and put them together and make sense of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's confusing, that kind of thing. And I think that's, you know, in a way the core of psychosis, sort of terror and confusion. And you know, it even happened to me at a very young age. I don't think I had a psychotic illness then, but
mm-hmm.
It was part of what is part of my later experience.
Right. You describe it as being like a sand castle
exactly.
That's being washed away from
right.
The shore.
All the sand sliding away into the receding surf and sort of no center to take things in and put them together.
Right. And then you also mentioned that you had an experience with mescaline back in high school.
I did.
Now, that's something that is, some people say, can precipitate, you know, like a schizophrenia or bipolar or something like that.
Well, some people even say that a teenager smoking pot increases the risk of getting schizophrenia.
And in your experience, is that true? Or
I don't really think it had that effect on me, and none of my doctors has ever thought that.
Okay. So. One of the concepts when you talk about disorganization, it kind of reminded me of what some people call like ego death, where on a psychedelic they sort of lose touch with their sense of personal identity, and it's more just like a I can't put it any better than you put it. But is there any comparison that you found between those two states of consciousness?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. I mean, on the mescaline, I saw like colors and patterns, and
right.
when I become psychotic, I get, you know, confused about reality.
Okay, so it's not...
For me, it's a very different thing. Maybe for other people, not.
I
mean, I do say that sometimes when I say, you know, I'm going to describe my experience of psychosis, but it's mine because everybody becomes psychotic in her or his own way.
Right. And then you also mentioned that around this time, like, you read The Bell Jar.
Yeah.
And you were in class one day, and you decided to get up and walk home. When you got home, what was your parents' reaction?
I think they were confused. I think that they didn't know what to think or what to do. I mean, it was a day and time where mental health wasn't on parents' radar screens the way it is today.
Right.
So they just thought it was some fluke, and don't worry about it. It probably won't happen again. And of course, it did eventually.
What do you think would have, what kind of difference do you think it would have made if...
It's hard to say. I mean, if I had gotten into treatment earlier, I may have been able to avoid some of the worst kind of ravages of the illness. Maybe not, but maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
You went to Vanderbilt.
I did.
Which is awesome because that's where my sister went to school.
Oh, cool.
She just graduated recently.
That's great. What did you major in?
She did business and English.
So, nice combination.
Yeah. And then you went from there to study at Oxford,
mm-hmm.
where I believe you said you had your first full-blown psychotic episode. Could you describe what that was like? Were you aware of what was happening as it happened?
So my first full-blown episode was really severe depression with some psychotic symptoms, some paranoia. So I felt like I was a bad person, that I was evil and didn't deserve to live, and, you know, thought I should kill myself, and thought, you know, if I did that, it would so destroy my family. So I actually sought treatment voluntarily.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was hospitalized for a month the first year, 4 months the second year, and then I got into analysis 5 days a week, which really steadied me and held me. So for the next 3 years, I did fine, and then I went to Yale Law School, and I wasn't in treatment. And I had a, you know, very big breakdown then. So it's actually been since 82, 83 was the last time I was in a hospital. And I sometimes like to say, that's my proudest accomplishment. And then I kind of say, well, but that's kind of strange. If my cancer didn't come back, I wouldn't say that I was, proud. I would say that I was lucky.
Right.
You know? And in some ways that this is the case with the mental illness as well. But I've... unlike many people, have had all the resources to get really, really good care. So I'm 5 day a week therapy, and I see my pharmacologist once a week, and I just have a lot of support and a lot of help.
And, which is amazing, because that's...
Well, I sometimes feel guilty, like, you know, survivor guilt, but I also am happy, you know, that
right.
it's worked out that way. Yeah.
That's, because one thing I was going to ask you is, do you feel like yours is a typical... experience for someone with schizophrenia, and if not, is it possible to bring, is it just a matter of resources to bring more people to where you're at?
Well, one thing I would say is I'm not unique. Sometimes people say I am, but I've done a study with some folks, including Dr. Steve Martyr at UCLA, who's a schizophrenia expert on, quote, high-functioning schizophrenia. We've got 2 JDs, 2 MDs, PhD candidate, a CEO of a not-for-profit, a full-time teacher. There are other people out there. It's just the stigma so severe that, you know, people don't you know, want to come forward. And I once asked Steve, who, again, is, like, the premier expert, what percentage of people did he think with schizophrenia were high-functioning in our sense, professional, managerial, technical? I don't know, Ellen. The real question is how many could be if we devoted proper resources. And I thought that was the right answer.
Mm.
we just need to do more to step up to the plate to give people the care they need. And I really believe, notwithstanding what people said about me, that I would, you know, have a grave prognosis and live in a board and care and never work,
right,
that most people with proper resources can kind of live up to their pre-illness potential.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That's and one of the things you mentioned when you say analysis, that's therapy, in other words. How most people, when they think of schizophrenia, they probably think, oh, we'll just give them, you right. know, the pills and that's all you can do.
Right.
To what extent is analysis helpful?
I'll say one thing first, which is it used to be thought that medication was enough, but recently, like within the last year, the New York Times reported a story about how now the conventional and correct wisdom is that schizophrenia is best addressed with both medication and, quote, psychosocial treatment, including therapy. So that's actually thought that it's not just something you cure with a pill.
Okay.
For me, it's been totally essential. I mean, I feel like I've needed both therapy and medication, and without both of them, I would be, you know, really in bad shape. I struggled about taking medication for a long time. You know, I kept wanting to get off of it and trying to get off of it, as you know from my book.
Right.
You know, basically because I wanted to believe that, you know, if I could get off the meds, I could prove that I wasn't really ill. It was all a big mistake, you know, but I couldn't get off them. And once I decided to stay on them continuously, my life got much better. So, you know, there are a lot of controversies about what mental illness is and how do you distinguish it from eccentricity or difference or whatever. For me, it's a biochemical illness that needs medication and therapy, and I believe that not because I've done sort of the heavy philosophical lifting around what mental illness is,
right,
but because it works for me, it makes my life better. And if it makes your life better to think, or someone else's life better to think that it's an alternative way of being, that's all the more power to you.
So how was it?
I can talk about also how I think the therapy works.
Yeah, let's hear
it. Is that what you're going to ask?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, good. Okay. So I think a bunch. It's the question. It's the main question for everybody, and not just people with psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's done a number of things. First, stress is bad for all illness, especially mental illness. And being able to identify your stressors, and either avoid them or manage them or cope with them is really important. Second, it sort of fortifies a quote observing ego, where you kind of stand back and observe what's going on in your mind and assess it. Third, it's kind of a safe place to say these things that are worrying you and tormenting you. If you didn't have that kind of safety valve, maybe you'd say it more in your external life and get into a lot more trouble socially,
right,
and so on. I think it also, you know, you can also develop insight. So some people think psychotic symptoms are just like random firings of neurons and with no meaning. Some people think they have meaning. They tell the truth about your psychic reality, but it doesn't help people to tell them. And some people think it helps some people to tell them. And that I was in that camp. So my doctor once said, Ellen, I think you're saying all these, you know, violent and scary things because you're really scared yourself. You know, the violence is your defense against your own fear. And that made it get better. And then finally, having a smart and kind and well-meaning person who kind of accepts you not only for the good, but also the bad and the ugly feels really nice.
Yeah.
And one finally, that was, I said finally, but here's another finally,
yeah,
is... a lot of, you know, these days people think of not so much reduction or remission of symptoms, but sort of recovery and quality of life.
Mm.
And quality of life is for the person herself or himself to say what that is for them. But the therapy can help with that. I mean, put it another way, people with schizophrenia have relationship and work problems the way other people do, and they can benefit from,
right,
addressing those.
Okay. When did the talk therapy help at all? Sticking to medication?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, that's a really good question. So it's something that I worked on in the therapy, you know, coming to terms with having the illness and needing the medication. It was a big, big part of the treatment.
And that's something that a lot of people with schizophrenia and a lot of different illnesses, I guess, but have trouble, like, accepting, as you said, that they have to take some kind of medicine.
Although I tried to find the study and I couldn't, so maybe I'm misremembering, but I seem to remember in college, like intro psych, there was a study where, like, these investigators stood outside the elevator in a medical office building mm-hmm. and counted how many people threw away their prescriptions before they got in the elevator.
Yeah.
So nobody likes to be on meds.
Oh.
They don't have to. So.
Fair enough. Was there something in particular that helped you, like, stick to a drug program, or was it, because it took many years, right?
You know, my analyst kind of really put pressure on and said, you know, look, you just need to stay on this. You know, I don't think I can work with you if you can't stay on this. So
oh, wow.
I gave it a try, and I was happy I did.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, like, I have a friend of mine who's mm-hmm. Hispanic, but he mm-hmm. looks white, and so mm-hmm. sometimes people say things about Mexicans in front of him. Do you ever have that experience? Because I think you mentioned, like, like some professor at Yale saying, like, oh,
right.
you know, restrain them, lock them up, or whatever, because right. they're not like you and I, Ellen.
Exactly.
Is that a common experience, or how do you deal with that in the world?
It's not common, but it does happen. I also had a friend here at the law school who hasn't been here for a long time, an administrator who said after my book was published, she's glad she didn't know I had schizophrenia before we started going out to dinner together. And I said, why? She said, I'd never go to dinner with you. I never would have gone.
Yeah.
But it hasn't happened that much, you know, to my face. You know, maybe it
okay.
does. Yeah.
Talking about, like, physically restraining.
Oh, God.
So what, how did you arrive at your position on that? And what is that position? And can you talk maybe a little bit about your own personal experience?
Sure. You know, I was restrained. England hasn't used restraints largely for 200 years or more. But America, depending on the place, uses them quite a bit. Actually, there's a lot of evidence that whether you're restrained has less to do with your symptoms and behavior than kind of the ethos of the hospital. So some places use them a lot and some places don't use them at all.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I was restrained when I was in New Haven, when I broke down at Yale. The first, like, 2 days, I was restrained, like, 20 hours a day for 2 days.
Oh, my gosh. And what are these restraints like?
So you're, like, tied spread eagle to a bed with cuffs and then have, like, a net or a sheet placed over your body so you really can't move. And it's, you know, it's actually physically very painful. You wouldn't expect it, but it's painful to be unable to move.
Oh, yeah.
It's also incredibly degrading, causes great feelings of helplessness. You don't know when you're going to get out, what you need to do to get out, when is this going to end.
Yeah.
It's just real. It was the most tormenting experience I've ever had, and I had nightmares about it for a long time. Seth. Fantasies that the patients in a hospital would rise up and put on the staff in restraints and let them feel what it was like. And actually, there was a guy at my psychoanalytic institute, because I've been trained analytically here, who was going to do a series of, do a documentary on mental health. He had some connections with the TV or movie industry. Unfortunately, he, like, suddenly died, like, in his mid-40s. But,
oh, geez.
Yeah, I know. He had, like, a heart attack or something. But he said, you know, I'd like to do something on restraints. You know, would you be willing to do a reenactment of a restraint episode? And I said, not in your life.
Yeah.
I would never do that. It would be too traumatic.
That's
So I've written about it. You know,
right.
I've written what I think the policy should be around restraints.
And what is that? What do you think the policy should be?
Well, I think a bunch of things. I think first, you should only allow restraints in the most exigent circumstances, when either someone's in transit and they might interfere with the driver, but then, you know, restrain them at one arm on the side of them.
Right.
Or the staff, the faculty, the doctors or the nurses or the aides need to be with you at close quarters and it's unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
Second, I would really procedurally burden the use of restraint. So New York has a pretty severe law, a restrictive law that, you know, you can only restrain someone for 2 hours, and then you have to let them out and see how they do, and then 4 hours, this other thing happens.
Mm-hmm.
And surprise, surprise, most people get out before the 2 hours are up because they don't want to use the resources to.
Right.
So that, the other thing is I would change the, like, liability incentives. So right now, if you don't restrain someone and injury ensues, you could be liable for negligence.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do restrain someone and they find it traumatic and toxic, it would be called a, quote, dignitary injury, and you'd get very little damages. And I would reverse that. I would say, if you don't restrain someone, an injury ensues, only if you were grossly negligent in deciding not to restrain them should you be liable. And that if you do restrain someone, you should be liable for greater than dignitary damages. So change the incentives of doctors. And then I would also, I would get rid of four-point spread eagle restraints. I just feel like it's too demeaning. I have been fortunate. I don't have any kind of abuse history in my life, but many people do.
Right.
And tying someone up like that just totally triggers and re-traumatizes people.
That so people are still in parts of the country or all over the country, they're allowed to do those spread eagle restraints?
Pretty much all over.
And when you say 20 hours a day, so four of those hours you can get up and walk around, or what's...
Well, no. I mean, for me, I was kept in a seclusion room. So
okay.
And
can you sleep while that's happening?
Not. That's very hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so strange because there's definitely a stigma of, you know, oh, these people are violent and stuff like that, where I think I've read studies that have shown they're actually less likely to cause violence.
Yes, it's the substance abusers who are the violent ones. And
yeah.
People with psychotic illnesses are much likelier to be victimized than victimizers. But that's a myth that we have about people with mental illness.
I don't want to take up too much of your time here, but one of the things I wanted to ask you is if there was something that you know now, or you could have a conversation with your high school or your college self, your much younger self, before you had been given a diagnosis and before you'd stabilized your life, what would you say?
Well, I mean, I think one thing, and I think this is not just about myself, but about everybody, you know, we give teenagers, you know, driver's ed and sex ed and, illness ed. We should give mental health ed so people have a basic literacy about what it looks like in themselves and other people. I think that's really... really kind of an important thing that we should do. And I guess I wish I had come to terms with and recognized a need for meds sooner. Mm-hmm. And so those are, you know, the two things that that I would do. And I would tell my, you know, one way I've been fortunate, a lot of people with schizophrenia, so people with schizophrenia have what are called positive symptoms like delusions and hallucinations, and negative symptoms like apathy and inability to work and inability to have friends. And actually, a lot of the burden of schizophrenia resides in the negative symptoms. And except for the first 2 years I was ill, I've been, like, blessed not to have those symptoms.
Right.
So I think, you know, the three things that have most helped me and that, you know, maybe could help other people are, first, you know, excellent treatment, you know, five-day-a-week therapy, great psychopharmacology. Second, supportive and loving family and friends who can sometimes serve as another set of eyes and see me slipping before I do myself. And then third, a job or a workplace that's both, for me, very intellectually stimulating, but also very accommodating and kind. For me, when I'm, like, writing an argument or a counter-argument, the kind of crazy stuff recedes to the sidelines. So work is, like, one of my best defenses against my mental illness. And then I've come to say, you know, my mind is both my best friend and my worst enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
That's, and then the last thing I wanted to ask you is what about us as a society?
Yeah.
What work still needs to be done?
We need to really try to reduce stigma. You know, the bad thing about stigma is it deters people from getting care. And, you know, people shouldn't suffer, but if they don't get care, it's likely that they will. So I really think we need to, you know, try to be more, understand more, care more, be less judging, and, you know, that kind of thing. It turns out, I mean, I think it seems, there's evidence that in industrialized societies, mental illness is worse, and in more developing countries, people do better. And some people think it's because, you know, society surrounds those people with love and care and doesn't just push them away.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, Alan Sachs, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Duncan Gammy. I appreciate appreciate your questions and your interest in the issues.
Thank you, Ellen Sachs, for talking to me. You can find her book, The Center Can Unhold, on Amazon and anywhere books are sold. Tune in next time, whenever next time might be. Thank you.